This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The movie Selma, about the historic confrontation between blacks and whites in the bitter days of the civil rights movement, didn't get any Oscars, you'll recall, except for its song. But perhaps the raw, gutsy heroism of minorities in the South 50 years ago needs no trophies from Hollywood today. One thing is certain, nobody is going to make a movie about the Supreme Court's lifting of Section 5 preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act back in 2013 and the weakness of Section 3C in challenging bias in the voting process. That's right. The way racial bias works today is very subtle, hard to get on newsreel footage. But a new Harvard study we're going to talk about may shed some light on the nuances of racial bias. Not a lot of drama there, but definitely some rich detail about how the voting bureaucracy can slow things down for some minority voters. That's later this hour. But over in the Middle East, it's a matter of life and death for minority Syrian Christians in the clutches of ISIS. There are hundreds in custody from an attack this week, the details of which are just emerging. The self-proclaimed Islamic State says the Assyrian Christian community is anti-Islamic, even though Assyrians predate Islam in the region by many centuries. ISIS thugs were seen in a video this week demolishing what looked like ancient Assyrian artifacts in an all-out assault on Christian culture. George Stifo is U.S. branch president of the Assyrian Democratic Organization, monitoring reports from the region and trying to reassure worried Christian families.
The attack happened early in the morning at 5 a.m. when people were asleep and not ready for the attack at all, and ISIS just took over the area. Currently, the number we have for hostages has exceeded 300. It's an unknown number. There are about 150 confirmed names that we can attest to, and the others are unknown, but we know that there are these numbers in the villages when ISIS took control of them.
Do you think ISIS is using their power over this minority to say that they have maybe more power than they actually do in that region over there by showing the world that they can persecute a group that's been persecuted traditionally?
Assyrians are ethnically indigenous to the land of Mesopotamia, which mainly northern Mesopotamia, which is northern Iraq, Syria, and southeast Turkey and parts of Iran. They've been living there for thousands of years. They've been living in peace and harmony in that region, and there have been persecutions along the years. Exactly 100 years ago, there were the massacres of World War I, where over 750,000 Assyrians were killed during that time. To say what ISIS is trying to do here, we have to remember, ISIS is a terrorist organization that has been killing thousands of Syrians, regardless of faith. But to them, Assyrians being Christian, they are infidels in the eyes of ISIS. These people do not deserve to live among ISIS. That, to them, that's how they look. They don't deserve to be alive. They don't deserve to be here. So to them, kicking these people out and killing them is the goal. In addition to that, it's a strategic move for ISIS to take control of the Khabur River and the banks, especially the southern bank, because if they want to attack the city of Hasakah, which is a major city, which is the capital of the governor of Hasakah, of the region, they could attack it at any minute and take it over. Not to mention, it's the water resources in the area that they can control now. And the region itself, it's a large region that borders three areas. That borders Turkey, that borders Iraqi Kurdistan, and that borders Iraq itself.
Let me ask you, you've made a really great sort of analysis of the strategic picture there. What is the state of the negotiations right now, and who's talking to whom, as far as you can tell?
As of now, there are negotiations taking place. This region has Arabs, Assyrians, Kurds, and these are the three major groups in the area. And you have a lot of Christians and a lot of Muslims in the area. So the Arabs are divided into tribes, and the tribal leaders among Arabs are the ones that are trying to do the negotiations with ISIS since they have connections with them. And it's happening through the Assyrian Church of the East leadership, in addition to leaders of the Assyrian community, mainly the Assyrian Democratic Organization. We are the leading Assyrian political party in Syria to negotiate with them the release of hostages, simply because these are civilians and they were not fighters. ISIS is claiming that they were only interested in fighters. and the number of fighters were extremely small. I mean, we're not talking about Assyrian fighters. These are people who are just women and children and elderly who are unable to flee the area. Also men who are husbands to these women and children and fathers to the children who stay there to protect their families. Civilians in their villages holding weapons trying to protect themselves. And to ISIS, they were fighters.
George Stifo is U.S. branch president of the Assyrian Democratic Organization. Thanks so much, George.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Is the Federal Department of Homeland Security a political hostage on Capitol Hill right now? Time is running out for funding the department as lawmakers are split over efforts to get at the White House executive orders on immigration reform. It's a matter of critical funding for Homeland Security, and in Washington, D.C., the nation's first director of Homeland Security, the former governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, says this showdown is bad news for Republicans.
I don't like to use war analogies, but I think they've chosen the wrong battlefield. The fact of the matter is I agree with my Republican colleagues that the president, once again, I think, has exceeded his constitutional authority with regard to the executive order on immigration. But I think he's been doing that rather regularly, starting with multiple changes to Obamacare, executive orders changing minimum wage and other regulations within the federal government. So there's no doubt in my mind my colleagues on the Hill, my Republican colleagues, are right. But I don't think you take that battle, you fight that effort, you challenge the president on the backs of the paychecks of the men and women who go to work every day at Homeland Security. I just think it's you've chosen the wrong forum to vet not only your opposition, but that doesn't change anything. What will change something, I believe, are a series of bills you send to the president about legislation and engage the broader public on the real issue, and that is immigration reform.
Thinking about the department and the many heroic men and women who work in the Department of Homeland Security, is this an agency that's too big to fail and that some lawmakers really need to remember that?
What my friends in Congress forget, these are men and women with families and obligations. They are also men and women with families and obligations that go to work every day being part of our effort to make America safer and secure. And why would you try to send a message to the President of the United States on the backs of the folks who have bills to pay just like you do, members of Congress? I just think that we ought to use the old-fashioned way. We are legislators. We control both chambers of the Congress of the United States. Let's engage the President in a legislative way, and let's take the issue to the substance of immigration reform, not just simply challenging the president's executive order.
What's the message to border security agents in Homeland Security who are maybe being told that nothing's really going to change here because no essential workers are affected?
Well, I think the message is that we give you it's cheap praise, it's false flattery to give speeches and thank the men and women who serve so valiantly, and at the same time not just give them their paycheck. I think the message is skewed and it's false when you praise their efforts and at the same time you don't pay them. And I think it's political folly as well, John. This is an inside the beltway game when they start talking about appropriations and the cloture rule in the Senate. All the folks outside the Beltway know is the Republicans won the House and the Republicans won the Senate. And we control both chambers of that body. And they're not getting into the fine details of what's transpiring in this legislative dust-up. The public outside wants us to govern. And frankly, it kind of brings it to mind, well, are these Republicans? I thought they promised there'd be no shutdowns.
Do you worry that there may be vulnerability on cyber attacks and those aspects of Homeland Security?
I'll tell you, John, the range of responsibilities that Homeland Security has is really rather substantial, and it's good it's all under one roof, but you got aviation security, you got maritime security, you got cybersecurity, you got border security, and it is a border-centric agency, and there's a lot of security issues that are involved in that, and the fact of the matter is that it is a real challenge, and I have a lot of empathy for Jay Johnson. You're asked to lead a department of over 200,000 people. Multiple missions. I mean, we've got to throw in the Coast Guard. They got multiple things they do. And you're asked to try to plan the year, send out grants, work with the state and local officials. Beef up your cybersecurity team. But by the way, we're going to use you as a political pawn. It's pretty tough to plan and prepare and provide the kind of effective leadership that you want when you don't know from week to week or continuing resolution to continuing resolution. You're going to have the money to do the things that you need to do.
I'm going to ask you one inside the Beltway question, Tom Ridge.
All right. I'm still here, so I guess hopefully I can answer it.
Should John Boehner go in the House as Speaker?
No, I think John Boehner has a really difficult job. But what I'd like to see my friend John Boehner do is take the clean bill from the Senate, put it on the floor of the House, up or down vote, and all those people, all those Republicans, and even I think probably more Republicans that just say to the world and to the men and women Homeland Security, we don't care about you having to pay your bills. We're just going to use you as pawns or hostages in the game. I believe he would get the majority of the Republicans and the majority of the Democrats to vote for it and let those who want to go off in this in the never-never land of this inside the Beltway game, let them go and do their own thing. But I think if John brought it to the floor, I think he'd pass. It would be passed overwhelmingly.
Tom Ridge, former Secretary of Homeland Security and former Governor of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Great pleasure to join you. Look forward to talking to you again, John. Thank you very much.
How's your homeland insecurity right now?
Hi, this is Gwen from Eustis, Florida.
Hey, John, this is Bill in Seattle.
My name is Marnin from Somerville, Massachusetts.
Stephen Best from Wilton Manors, Florida. Oddly enough, the vast Twitter network of people makes me feel as safe as the DHS. People communicating quickly can save lives.
Just knowing that we have a Congress that will work for the American people and pass a clean funding bill would certainly help as far as the safety in America would be concerned.
And I would feel a whole lot safer if we could disarm all the nukes that are spread across the country that are just ridiculous. They're sitting there waiting to malfunction or be hijacked or hacked in some way.
I think the one thing that could be done to make this country safer would be to have fewer laws. If the code of laws is relatively short, then government surveillance starts being less of a problem to citizens in general because they won't justifiably be afraid of being caught in an innocuous transgression as they are under the current system.
And this from Florida. I feel very safe in America, and I am so over the fear-mongering that has become rampant. High gas prices and soaring medical costs scare me much more than ISIS.
It's Dr. Bruce Parker calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. My answer is to teach us all to drive. Injuries and property damage from private vehicle crashes are much larger than all the scarier problems, bombs, airplane crashes, and the like.
This is Blaine from Beaverton. I'd feel safer with government officials actually working for the populace rather than their own political interests and corporate executives.
This is Michael from Seattle. I feel pretty safe as it is, but the one thing that would make me feel safer would be passing gun control legislation.
Ann Bangs, and I'm calling from Molino, Oregon. One thing that would make me feel safer in America would be if my government representatives would start to work together to improve on my core issues, which are education, the environment, and health care. I teach preschoolers, and they get along better with each other than my legislators do. I'm afraid they may understand these issues better than my legislators as well.
Hi, it's Cindy from New Jersey. I'm sorry, the way the world is nowadays, there's nothing that makes me feel safe anymore.
We always want to hear from you. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to have your say.
The Takeaway is supported by GiftedAndTalented.com, providing personalized online courses developed by Stanford University, designed to help K-12 students advance in mathematics, language arts, and beyond. More at GiftedAndTalented.com.
When the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Voting Rights Act in 2013, it was hailed as either an acknowledgement of greater racial parity in southern districts with a history of legal segregation, or it was condemned as a gutting of the act that protects minority rights against majority rule temptations to bring back something like this.
I ain't stirring no fuss. I'm just here trying to register to vote.
Recite the Constitution's preamble.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union.
How many county judges in Alabama?
67.
Name them.
That example of a discriminatory barrier to black voters from the movie Selma is illegal today and long gone. But when the Supreme Court lifted the federal oversight voting rules in historically segregated districts, they also opened a window on the various rules for voting all over the country. Now a new study from Harvard has begun to look at data that reveals the effect of bias in a bureaucratic voting process with rules that may not be well understood. Ariel White and Noah Nathan are PhD candidates in government at Harvard and the study's authors. One thing they've found is that racial bias is clearly one reason some voters may not make it to the polls.
What we're actually finding is a much more subtle implicit bias that's similar to bias that's been found in all sorts of other experiments similar to ours in other fields with loan officers, HR workers, doctors, real estate agents that show that people, when they make discretionary decisions about others, can be implicitly biased to minorities and how helpful they're going to be, even if they don't actually intend ill to those people. And that's something that we find in our experiment. So the people who didn't give as accurate or as informative responses to Latinos weren't being intentionally inaccurate or constructing barriers. They just weren't being as helpful and as forthcoming as they could be. And they might not even be aware that they themselves are being biased. But the aggregate effects of this in the population are that people from minority groups may be getting less informative information when they ask questions to these officials.
So is it fair to say that under the current system that you looked at, there is a system out there that permits bias, even if it doesn't actually structurally encourage bias in the way we saw in the movie Selma?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think the point is that individuals, when they make discretionary decisions about others, can be implicitly biased in all sorts of ways. And if we don't take that into consideration when we design and implement these policies, we can get biased outcomes, even if bias wasn't the intent going in.
So, Ariel, if a system permits bias, what actually happens at the level of voters that would cause them not to go to the polls?
We looked at just one manifestation of this, which is, you know, we emailed asking for some basic information, just as we would think that voters might do. Certainly, a lot of local officials sent some very helpful and thorough responses.
Which is good.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that we did find, though, was that on average, when we sent those emails, the same text of the same email from a Latino-sounding name, we got fewer responses overall. So we just more often heard radio silence. And we got slightly less thorough responses. So maybe someone would say, yes, you need to bring an ID, such as a driver's license, but actually you could bring all sorts of other IDs and they wouldn't mention that. So just slight differences in quality.
Now, slight, of course, is, the devil is in the details about
exactly.
All of this, because you add up a bunch of slights and all of a sudden you've got, 10, 20 electoral votes at risk here. In looking at this kind of thing that you're seeing, and again, this is the first real data that anyone's really even talked about, which is what's so interesting here. Can you see any way of correcting, challenging, creating the sort of legal framework to protect voters in this environment versus the much blunter situation that was the case in Selma in, the 1960s?
We didn't find the bias that Ariel was mentioning in a certain subset of jurisdictions in the United States, and those were jurisdictions that were covered for preclearance under several provisions of the Voting Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And these are areas that have additional federal scrutiny of local election procedures to make sure that they don't discriminate, and we found that in these areas, the officials didn't discriminate in their responsiveness or in the accuracy of their responses to our questions. We can't say that that's specifically because of the Voting Rights Act, but it's suggestive evidence that when you have people looking over your shoulder and making sure you aren't biased. And so procedures that explicitly recognize that bias exists and try to take precautions against it are probably necessary to make sure that it doesn't come to the forefront in situations like this.
The huge takeaway here that comes out of your very careful, examination of this data suggests that, the argument that was very passionate right after the Shelby decision, which was, oh, my goodness, the preclearance, which was challenged as an onerous, humiliating regulation on these specific counties based on history that's changed, is actually based on your data a great idea to have everywhere in the country. Is that what your data is seeming to hint at right now, Ariel?
I do think that, as Noah said, there's room for monitoring here to change people's behavior in terms of implicit bias. I'm not sure I would go quite that far. Noah, what do you think?
I think the best analogy here actually comes from Justice Ginsburg in the Shelby decision, in which she argued, you're not getting wet. Is that because it's not raining or because you're holding up an umbrella? And the question is, should you close the umbrella? And that was the decision that they they made, was to close the umbrella, get rid of the Voting Rights Act, those provisions at least. And I think what we can show you is that, yes, even these jurisdictions that are covered by the Voting Rights Act, they're not getting wet, but everyone else is getting wet everywhere else in similar jurisdictions around the country. And so you can connect the dots as to whether the umbrella of the Voting Rights Act is doing the work there. And I think there's suggestive evidence that that's the case. And I do agree that thinking about how to monitor against discrimination everywhere might be the solution to this.
Do you feel just personally excited to be doing this kind of work, to really sort of seeing on a very deep level how democracy is functioning or not functioning so well at this critical moment of history, Ariel?
Certainly. I mean, I think one of the other things that we saw in the Shelby decision was that we do need a critical mass of social science research that can address this question. I know a number of social scientists stepped in and filed briefs in that case, and it seems that some members of the court didn't find that compelling. But I think we do just need to keep amassing information on how this looks across the country.
I agree as well. And I think that experiments like this are particularly important because with an experiment like this, you can't explain this bias away based on anything else. These are exactly the same emails sent to thousands of people. Everything about them is the same except for the name, so that the name, the ethnicity of the person sending them, is really the only thing that can plausibly be causing these differences in treatment. And so I think with a lot of evidence, people can say, oh, well, they can sort of rationalize away bias and racism. And I think with experiments, it becomes very hard to do that logically. And I think that's what's so important about this kind of analysis.
Ariel White and Noah Nathan, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, my pleasure.
Ariel White and Noah Nathan are PhD candidates in government at Harvard University and co-authors of this new study on bias in the voting system.
The Takeaway is supported by ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at shopkeep.com. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th.
The chairman of the FCC was ecstatic.
Today, history is being made by a majority of this commission as we vote for a fast, fair, and open internet.
Chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Tom Wheeler, announcing the vote to establish net neutrality as a basic federal principle of internet commerce. Many of you in the Takeaway community were celebrating last night in a Twitter chat right after the vote. At Evan Wolf writes, meaningful internet access could be drawn as a civil right. You can't act as a citizen without it. Or Marvin Amore tweeted, corporations are people is one more reason to care. Imagine if presidential campaigns had to raise more money for fast lanes. You can go to thetakeaway.org and see all of the comments from the Twitter chat and engage in that discussion. It was not a celebratory mood, though, for some on Capitol Hill. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick sat down with Republican Senator John Thune from South Dakota. He's the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee and the man who could lead Republican efforts to override the FCC. Todd sat down with him and lived to tell the tale. Todd, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
Right off the bat, what color is the dress? Is it white and gold or black and blue? What is it?
I engaged in this right before I went to bed. It reminded me of my old days as a neuroscience student. I remain agnostic.
Oh, you're such a wuss. No, but your eyes told you what color it was.
White and gold, my friend.
Thank you
white
very
and
much. I'm on team white and for gold. Heaven's sakes, you could be a senator. All right, what was South Dakota Senator John Thune's reaction to the vote yesterday?
Well, look, not only is Thune chairman of the Commerce Committee, he's also number three in the Senate, chairman of the Republican Conference. And his reaction was really that the FCC had gone heavy-handed. Listen.
What concerns me about all this is that, what the FCC did in basically regulating it under Title II of the – reclassifying it under Title II of the 1934 Comms Act is it really does I think put the FCC in a position where if they wanted to in the future, they could do many of the things that act allows them to do. They could exercise the authorities that are granted under Title II. And I think that's the thing that people ought to be concerned about.
But are people really aware that the FCC might do other stuff, after this vote?
Well, I think the big thing that he's concerned about is in the future the FCC could regulate rates. They've said they're not going to, but that doesn't stop a future FCC or a future president from regulating rates from internet service providers. And that's really what he's concerned about. Now, Thune essentially says that the FCC is fixing what isn't broken and concerns about throttling and paid prioritization are really hypothetical at this point.
So does his solution rule out the question of raising rates? And does he have a metaphor that would basically change the status quo at all?
I mean, Thune has a draft bill that hasn't reached the floor yet that he's hoping to get some bipartisan support on that would outlaw the things that people don't want, like that paid prioritization and throttling and paying for faster internet lanes, but that would also outlaw things like rate regulation and keep the FCC out of a lot of the back end of the internet.
So then he would outlaw the rate regulation. And his attitude is that it doesn't apply. What went on in 1934 with the railroads and with the telecom industry doesn't apply today?
Well, he just thinks that the Title II of the Telecommunications Act from 1934 is antiquated. It regulates hard internet lines. And that basically with the innovation that's gone on in the last 20 years of the internet, the regulatory scheme that exists in what people see as net neutrality is going to land people in court and is going to prevent innovation on the internet.
And this is how Thune puts it.
We're going to take a 1934 law and use that as the basis to regulate the internet, which for two decades has benefited from a light regulatory touch. This is a very heavy-handed government approach that involves a lot of bureaucratic decision-making instead of the innovative approach, I think, that has been used in terms of regulating the internet for a long time now.
Light regulatory touch, is that the new messaging from Thune and the Republicans? I haven't heard that before.
You've heard it around a couple of places. I've heard that phrase used by Thune and a number of other people involved on the telecommunications side. And I think light regulatory touch is really what they're going for, and also a warning in what Thune has called a radical change in regulation, which is that with all radical changes in regulation, this thing is winding up in court, and that internet companies that are in favor of the FCC enforcing net neutrality are going to find themselves fighting in court under Title II, and that they might not like that. He says, I have a bill that can keep you out of court. It'll do the things that you want. It'll prevent some things that Republicans don't want or that you don't want, like rate regulation, but you won't wind up suing everybody and getting sued for the next 10 years. Listen.
You know, it was a really abrupt departure and really a radical change even for the FCC because, like I said, for two decades, it's been kind of the doctrine at the FCC that internet services aren't going to be treated as telecommunication services. They're treated as information services. Therefore, they don't fall under the auspices of Title II. And so this was a very abrupt change, and it does smack of big government intervention into an area of our economy that has really prospered and thrived. We've seen robust growth in the internet, and I don't know why you would go away from what has worked when there is a better way if you're concerned about potential abuses. We got a six-page bill that takes care of that.
What does he say to the argument that, you know, to classify the internet as an information service when it's become so ubiquitous, almost like the oxygen in the atmosphere around us, is a little bit naive and that the FCC is basically dealing with this new reality?
Well, John, we talked about the metaphor of the internet as a sidewalk, right? The sidewalk is where everybody has access, but businesses can put their flowers out there, their fruits and vegetables. Everyone wants equal egress into their businesses so that you can walk around, and nobody has the right to slow you down on the sidewalk or shove you off of the sidewalk. Thune said he agrees with the metaphor in principle, but the internet isn't necessarily a public sidewalk. Somebody built the sidewalk. A private company invested to build the sidewalk. And if you want the sidewalk widened or to have better pavement, somebody's got to pay for it and somebody's got to make the investment. And if you make the sidewalk too hard to invest in, it's always going to be narrow and bumpy, and it might not be one that you want to walk on or build your business on.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
You had me at hello.
You won't take me seriously just because I'm 17.
Studying is hard and boring.
Boring!
Glad you were looking for me. Nobody's forcing you to be here. You have a choice. You can stay or you can leave. Come on, ladies. There's no wrong answer.
You had me at Friday. Yes, Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meinzer are here with the Movies on Friday. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer of The Takeaway. Together, they host the Movie Day podcast. Welcome again.
Hi.
Thanks,
happy
John.
Friday, John.
Oh, the Oscars are over. It's back to normal. It's like regular.
Thank goodness.
Yes. We can all focus.
Oh, no, you didn't.
Ooh,
you
thank
did
you.
Not.
Yep, that's the movie out this week. Will Smith, Margot Robbie, Rodrigo Santoro. Let's hear a clip.
Attention is like a spotlight.
And our job is to dance in the darkness.
I didn't even feel you take that.
The human brain is slow, and it cannot multitask.
Jesus, when...
Human behavior is very predictable. I touch you here, I steal from here. I tap you here, I steal from here.
I can't tell. What is this, Romeo and Juliet meets Ocean's 11? What do you think, Richard?
Well, he's a con artist. That's Will Smith. Margot Robbie is his protege. They become romantically entangled, but he pushes her away. He doesn't want to get too close, and then they cross paths again years later. I think the movie wants you to have this kind of who's playing who ideas. Is he going to double-cross her? Is she actually playing him? But in fact, there isn't really actually much of that going on. You just get a lot of this kind of con man lingo, the things about focus and distraction and multitasking. We've seen all that before. You've seen someone take a watch off someone's wrist before. That's about all this movie has to offer.
Didn't Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie do a movie about they were both hitmen?
Oh, are you thinking about Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
Yeah.
That was Hitman, not Con Man.
Right, exactly. So what did you think of this?
In this movie, there's something very different between Mr. and Mrs. Smith and this, which is I feel no sexual chemistry. And I think that lot of what we are relying on for this movie to work is for these two to really play off of each other in a way that we don't know if they actually have genuine feelings or not. That's what they want us to think. But the whole time, I just thought, there are no genuine feelings, there's no sexual chemistry, and I don't care.
Dead on arrival, focus. Maybe it needs a Lazarus effect, the other movie we're looking at today.
Okay, look, listen to me, okay? Your brain was failing due to the lack of oxygen. You're hallucinating from the DMT. This is a terrible memory from your childhood, but it's playing in a traumatic loop. It's like...
It was hell. That's what hell is. You relive the worst moment of your life on a loop. Over and over, and you can never wake up.
Sell that movie. Yes, indeed. Lazarus Effect. Rafer, what do you think?
That's Mark Duplass, who's just injected Olivia Wilde's head with some Lazarus serum and brought her back from the dead. They're scientists. They've been performing these experiments, and now it's happened to a human. I think you know the drill on this kind of stuff. People are going to get picked off one by one in the lab. There's a few good jolts in it. I think one of the problems is it's made by Blumhouse Productions, who are the guys who did Paranormal Activity, Sinister, Insidious. And so you get a lot of that kind of nonsense. There's always going to be some creepy voices, burning dolls, creepy children, spooky black-eyed demons. That kind of stuff is sort of par for the course. It's 83 minutes. It doesn't outstay its welcome. It's over pretty quickly. It's not a terrible movie, but it's not great.
Good performances?
Olivia Wilde actually is quite good. You wouldn't think that she's, but she is. She puts the little black contact lenses in and has to do some snarling, but she's actually pretty good at it.
Well, those are the two offerings on the movies for this weekend, Lazarus Effect and Focus. But on the podcast, you actually have something to share with us, Kristen, from your podcast this week that relates to something that I certainly love.
Yeah, so we were very lucky. We got to sit down with Jemaine Clement, who is one half of the Flight of the Conchords musical duo. We just love him. And he came in to talk about a new movie that he co-wrote, co-directed, and he co-stars in. It's a horror comedy mockumentary about vampires when they're not out killing virgins and drinking blood and just on their downtime. Here's a clip.
I do my flat chores.
No, you don't.
No, yes,
don't.
I do.
That's why we're having the flat meeting.
The point is, Deacon, that you have not done the dishes for 5 years.
Vladislav is right. It's unacceptable to have so many bloody dishes all over this bench like this.
I'm so embarrassed when people come over here.
What does it matter? You bring them over, you kill them. Vampires don't do dishes.
A pretend documentary.
Yes. And he talked with us about the movie, beginning with how he wanted to tell a different kind of vampire story.
This is filming them when they're not just being the cool, mysterious guy at the window. Also the other times when there are other windows and they don't manage to hypnotize the people in the room and you know, the times when they're being not so cool and not so mysterious. And a lot of people don't think about, you know, a lot of vampires are wealthy in movies, but what if you didn't invest right in, imagine trying to make that last. It's hard to get jobs. Most of them are in the daytime.
Right. Age discrimination. Mm. Yeah.
These vampires are super not sexy.
No, I think we're trying, but no.
I mean, there's some flying and some fighting scenes, which
are
great.
Yeah, they're not that sexy.
You know, vampires turning into bats and doing that kind of thing. But some of the scenes are just so deadpan and fantastic. And Rafer and I especially loved Nick and Stu.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Can you tell us more about these actors who play Nick and Stu?
Sure. Nick is played by Corey Gonzalez-McCure. He's a comedian. He'd never been in a film before. and she's just a natural. And then Stu is actually an IT guy. He plays an IT guy in the film.
Yes.
In real life, he is an IT guy. He was just helping us out filming it, like making sure people didn't trip over when we were filming in town and carrying stuff. And we thought he looked so different to the rest of us and had a different energy, I guess. He wasn't a performer. He was a software analyst. But so we just put him in there. And when we saw him there, he stood out a lot. So we made his part quite major when we were writing the script. We didn't let him know. We didn't want to freak him out.
No wonder, because they're both, you know. I hope this is no insult to Corey, but I never would have known that either of them were a comedian. You know, they both. When I saw the film, I just kept thinking, did they just pull these guys off the street? Did they really just get these guys just out of nowhere? But that's great about Stu. A star might have been born there. He's terrific in the film.
We have had when we've gone to film festivals at the end of the film. People stand up when Stu comes out.
That's great. That's terrific. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
And you made this film for about $1 million. Is that right?
Yes.
So that's
a lot of money, right?
It's a lot of money, although not when we're talking about movies.
No, not as far as movies go. It's about a 200th of many movies.
Yeah, exactly. And so we know that you had to call in, as I think independent filmmakers do, you had to call in a lot of favors, mm-hmm. one of them from Peter Jackson. Tell us how that came about.
Well, there's lots of favors from Peter Jackson. He lent us cameras. The outside of the vampire's house is actually his office.
Oh.
That's his office.
Yeah. Creepy looking office.
Creepy.
It's one of his offices. Our set is made of the discarded green screen of the Hobbit set.
All right.
Wow. Peter Jackson often helps any New Zealand movie. Seems to help somehow.
What was your entree into him? Did you certainly didn't knock on that creepy office and say, "Hey, Peter Jackson."
We went and visited him while they were making The Hobbit, and told him the idea and just, "Is there any way you can help?" We were hoping he would say, "Have $1 million."
Sure,
but he didn't say that. But he did say, "Have some cameras, and we might be able to help you with some other ways."
All right, well, that's cool.
That's
enough.
Great.
Yeah, yeah.
Flight of the Conchords, Jermaine Clements, What We Do in the Shadows. It's a comedy vampire mockumentary. The full fawning and utterly delightful conversation with Rafer Guzman and Kristen Meiser is part of this week's Movie Date podcast. And that's the way it is. Oops, one last detail. Scientists have discovered a massive black hole at the heart of a quasar 12.8 billion light years away. It's bigger than, let me check this, 12 billion suns. That's big. But not as big as the series we're doing next week on The Takeaway about exoplanets. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at John Hockenberry, or check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Now we're done.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.